Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, when Koshin invited me to come visit him, I jumped at the opportunity because I love him so much, and his family, and this island, but mostly him and his family, and you guys, but mostly him and his family. And I kind of ignored the fact that he had asked me to do stuff like give this talk. And then I wrote it yesterday and I had a sort of dim sense of how goofy it was. But it's not his fault. He just trusted I'd do a better job, I think, of preparing my talk and being serious, and now I'm feeling really bad about it. So there's this guy who he's a Japanese speaker, and he used to give speeches to both Japanese audiences and Japanese and English audiences in English, and he said when he gave his speeches in English, he would always start with a joke. And when he gave his Japanese speeches, he would always start with an apology. And then he said, so I'm going to apologize for not having a joke. But I've kind of turned it around, and I made a joke of my apology, and I don't know what that all means. But there is differences in Japanese and, you know, Western cultures that are interesting to get into. So anyway, I would like to begin my thing with a homemade invocation. I invoke all the love, caring, and effort made by so many over many years to form and sustain this practice center. I invoke all the love, caring, and effort made by so many over many, many years, both in the East and the West, to guide our human existence on this planet toward harmony and perfection. I invoke all the power of life spreading, expanding, starting from the hot, bright core of the Earth and all the celestial bodies and moving down and out and up and in and everywhere through all life forms, our roots and hearts entwined and rising up in song. I invoke all the power of wisdom and intelligence guiding the laws of nature being focused and distilled down into our own knowing of ourselves and our world. I invoke the inspiration of all people trying to give helpful talks all over the world right now, and for many years ago, and for many years to come. This is going to be a pretty short talk. My goal is to hopefully pique your interest in a thing or two, and then even more hopefully deeper into it after the talk, or at least discern some coherent idea in the whole talk. Right from the start, I'd like to point out how excited I am to be here at this particular modern Western Rinzai Zen Center. I feel like this group is part of a worldwide movement of the evolution of Buddhism, and all of us doing this have inherited simultaneously at least two different strands, the evolution of Buddhism and Zen, and whether we like it or not, the evolution of the Western tradition of emotional, psychological betterment that started, as Koshin told me last night, well before Freud, and now has blossomed into tassels of bookstores filled with interesting ideas. We're part of that too. The religious tradition of Zen includes invocations, and of all the many different parts of the religious tradition, including these robes and Buddha statues and stuff, I'd just like to say a very few words about invocations. To me, they're weird. There's this sort of like magical thinking. They're calling out for hosts of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and magical powers to come help us. I mean, mine was really weird, but I don't have a very strong opinion about the literalness of invoking things. But I do believe in the power of imagination and how our imaginative power can mesh with nature. So please close your eyes. And I now invoke your ability to know where you are. So please remember exactly where you are and let that wisdom rain down on you. And now let the wisdom of knowing you are in emptiness come down on you. So, this is the preamble. This is all just to say that I'm very excited about the creative time that we're now in history. And even though there's tons of scandals and troubles and nonsense, I still remain hopeful and optimistic about this evolution of Zen and everything. I just can't get up. I just can't talk without making a preamble. My son hates it. I have something important I want to tell him, and then it takes me like 10 minutes to get in. He's just tell me what's bothering you. And I'm like, blah, 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 the world and this and that. And, but anyway, now for the title of this pretty short talk. It is Zen Practice in Everyday Life. I imagine when many of you hear the words Zen practice in everyday life, you think of the fact that our concentration and insight that we cultivate in Zazen and Kinhin and chanting is not just limited to Zazen and Kinhin and chanting. We can do our Zen practice everywhere. And there's a whole compendium of literature on this, and it's Zen and the art of archery and such and such and so, and cooking and dancing and so many things, digging trenches. And, you know, our teacher, Joshu Sasaki Roshi, a lot of his koans were pretty much that. So he'd say, how do you realize? And then he would put in different things like one true nature or true love or Buddha. Something really good. True, absolute love. And then he'd say something like when you're washing the dishes or when you're driving the car or when you see the pine tree or when you see the flower. So that's pretty endless. And I think it's really good. there's a sense, and I think it's a true sense, that our daily life experience becomes quote-unquote Zen-ish when we throw ourselves into an action. When we stop talking to ourselves and we stop perseverating, choosing, and we've chosen, and we 100% with all our mind and body and breath and warm, wet, beating, emotional hearts, do something! Act! And that's when you get, of course you can do it when you're sitting too, that's when you get all of these famous phrases of mind and body, inside, outside, subject, object, become one, and everything falls away, and you're in samadhi. Zen in everyday life. But I think our lives are complicated. So the one hint I want to give about that sort of Zen in everyday life is to really notice when you've chosen, when you're not waffling anymore, when you're not choosing, in the state of choosing, in the state of being distracted, when you've really chosen, like, I'm in my car, I'm going to work. Then you can completely drive. But if you're still thinking, do I really want to go to work or whatever, and blah, blah, blah. So just notice those moments when you've totally chosen. And then you can jump into action. But that's not really what I want to talk about. Even though there's a lot more to talk about that side of Zen in everyday life, and this talk is pretty short. And so I'm going to talk about another side. I think that Zen in everyday life can be, perhaps, categorized into two dimensions. You have your breadth, and then you have your depth. I hate that word, actually. So deep, man. You have your depth of Zen in everyday life. So the breadth, of course, is that we can practice all the time, even when we're deciding, you know, to get up and get a drink during the advertisements of the Super Bowl, or maybe we want to see the, you know, but we can still be practicing once we've chosen whether we're going to watch that or go get a drink. But the depth comes into play more when you take the koan. How do you realize Buddha while washing the dishes? When you focus on the Buddha that isn't the transcendent mind and body fallen away, no thinking Buddha, but it's the Buddha with a personality, the human Buddha, the Buddha who has an opinion washing the dishes. That's where you get the depth. And it comes more into play, I think, in more drastic situations. How do you realize Buddha when the house is on fire and you can't get out? How do you realize Buddha when someone you love dies or is in big trouble or something big in the world, like a natural catastrophe or a war? Then I don't think it's enough just to do the full body, sensory, rich breathing with your whole body. Then you need some kind of world view to not be fazed by anything that the world can throw at you. So this being unfazed doesn't necessarily mean, I hope, being unemotional, but it does mean not being led by our negative emotions. And I think the wisdom aspect, the worldview aspect, does directly relate to the concentration and insight aspect, the samadhi aspect. Because the clearer and firmer we are about our worldview, then the less time we spend being confused and not having chosen. The less time we spend being distracted. So I'd like to try to give some concrete examples of this, of how those two things interact with each other, are sort of hand in hand with each other. And to leave aside death and destruction and burning houses for a minute, something that happens a little bit more often, or at least the thought of it happens more often, sex. I think we should talk about sex. But before we jump right into sex, first I'd like to ask a question. Who here is familiar with the five sila of Buddhism? Please raise your hand. One? This will happen last time I gave a talk. I was like, who hates koans? And I thought everyone's going to raise their hand, and they're like, nobody raised their hand. Okay. All right. So we're going to talk about so I have to go step back a little bit, talk about the five sila, what they are. The five sila are...
We named them as precepts.
Oh, who knows the five precepts? Raise your hand. Woo! Oh, thank you. Excellent. Okay. So, precept number one, just call out.
Don't kill.
Number two.
Don't steal.
Number three.
Don't misuse sex.
Not yet. Hold on.
Right speech,
don't lie, like that. Number four.
Sex.
It's the sex one. And how do you guys say the sex one?
I don't remember exactly. It's
be aware of the suffering caused by sexual misconduct.
Thank you.
Being aware of
Professor
that
Steele.
We bow to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then number five?
No intoxicants.
So that's a very clearly stated one, yes. Of course, Mount Baldy said, don't drink sake too much. But, okay, so those are the five sila. And in the spirit of I was just joking around with my friend, because I don't have a Zen center. And she was saying, why do you have it? And I was like, if I had a Zen center, maybe we just have an a la carte precept. You know, if you don't like number four, you could just do two and three, maybe just one. You don't have to jump into all five. Have some big ceremony. But anyway, so let's now imagine a person who has deeply embodied the sila guiding us toward a fully mature, ethical, unselfish, unobsessive sex life. Imagine such a person. And so then that guy or woman, they don't waste a lot of time. They can jump into their actions. Like they're just walking down the street, and they see a poster of some sexy person that's trying to get them to buy aftershave, and they're like, no thank you, sila four. Someone says, a prostitute? Sila four. Some pornography? Or talk to the sila. You know, they're really clear, and then they can just keep on walking through life. They have a framework, a philosophical moral framework that they believe in, and that they've embodied, and they're not distracted by all of these choices that we, not just the direct choices like, hey baby, wanna come home with me? But the implicit choices that we get from media, from plays, from art, from advertising, very clear. So that, I think, is part of Zen in everyday life. You don't just talk about your breathing and listening to the sounds. You also have this framework that helps you navigate and not be confused. That's what I wanted to talk about. And the sex sila, I think, in its bigger context, is really talking about what it means to be an animal, a hairy animal, flooded with instinctual emotions, who has self-awareness and can think about enlightenment and world peace. What does that mean? If you really get what that means, then you really get the sex sila, and then you can navigate life better. So that's just one of the silas, but pretty short talk, so I'm going to move on. The fifth sila is also very fascinating. Perhaps you can think about that, you know, because we know that so many people in our lives suffer because of confusion about intoxicants and things that chemically change your mind. So, more broadly, besides ethical issues and death, illness, natural catastrophes, further, we are also bombarded with other people's philosophical frameworks. I'd say that nearly everything that's man-made has some kind of worldview implicit in it. So you have people saying their opinions that you have to be able to incorporate and their ideas. And then you have everything else too. And you can't really help having to deal with it. For example, just in the last week, I had people talk to me about what about ghosts? What about reincarnation, capitalism, the multiverse, racism, polyamory? What and where is God? How about global warming? Is this life just a simulation or what? That's just off the top of my head. We are constantly being bombarded by human-made concepts and ideas. And there's no way to pretend that you don't have to process those ideas. You have to. You have to have some kind of opinion about it. You must have your own opinion. Opinion. I'm going to say it, and then I'm going to wait. Okay. Having heard that, did any of you think about the famous Zen phrase? The great way is not difficult, just cease having opinions. People love that phrase. But I'm here to give this talk to tell you, I think that phrase is not very true. It's only somewhat true. To me, I think that we all have opinions. No one wants to be thought of as know-it-all, judgmental, highly opinionated, but there's no way not to have opinions. Even if your opinion is, I don't have a strong opinion about that, or I don't need to know about that, you still have an opinion. And the thing is, knowing what place those opinions have in your life. I think you have to have your opinion, and then you have to know how to let it go. I often say you have to let it go at the end of each breath. But don't pretend that you don't have an opinion. I think that will just make you a little sleepier. If you realize that every idea that anyone presents to you, instantly, you do have an opinion about it, then I think that will help your practice, rather than pretending you don't have an opinion about it. So, we weird people, I don't know if Koshin has talked to you about being a weird person. It's an acronym. It means Western education, industrialized, rich, and democratic. And most of us people in this modern Rinzai Zen world are that. And we pride ourselves in being inclusive. We really don't want to think that we're better than anybody, and we really don't want to think that we're different than anybody. And that is great. I mean, that I'm not making fun of us too much. I really think that we are wonderful in wanting to include everybody and not wanting to be riding on some kind of self-righteous high horse of we're better than you. But I think that we kind of can trick ourselves in our desire to be inclusive, and we can get mushy about what we really believe in. And that's why I brought up the sila earlier. Like, are we really willing to embrace those wholeheartedly in a way that we can really believe in and then be clear about them? Can we really embrace the sila for ourselves and still be perfectly fine with someone who has a different idea about what place sex should have in their lives? So, as we are cultivating our very clear view of the world that's able to incorporate all these different ideas and know where we stand, even if it includes a lot of "I don't know about that" very clearly, or "I don't have to have an opinion about the multiverse" very clearly, and then you move on. Even if it includes that, there's one other tricky opinion that we all, I don't think, can avoid, and that's the opinion we have about ourselves. And ourselves vis-a-vis other people. And I think that the more we have chewed on that and digested it and become clear about it, the more we can move through life and throw ourselves into practice, because we're not confused by that. I don't think it's possible not to have an opinion about ourselves. But how can we firmly hold our own way and not be hateful or patronizing or elitist? How can we have full and true love and respect for everyone and still believe they have misguided, hurtful opinions? So, When I'm talking about this sometimes to my partner Anna, I bring up these famous old Zen masters, and she really does not resonate with them, but I'm going to bring them up again. So there was Zuigan. Raise your hand if you heard of Zuigan. Thank you, Wes. I knew Wes. Zuigan sat on a rock in the evening instead of watching television. Sat on a rock and he talked to himself. "Master, yes. Pay attention. Yes. Master, yes. Do not be in Japanese it's Hito no ma no uku koto nakare." I love that word. Nakare means like, don't do it. Hito no ma means the trickery, the deception of others. And uku means to receive, to passively just receive. So it's usually translated, don't be deceived by others. And I think that's like he would just do that again through the night, those few little lines to himself. But I don't think, and Rinzai was big too on saying you must be the master of every situation. Master. And that's that, to me, that is that Buddha with a personality, Buddha with an opinion side of the koans. You're the master, but how can you be the master and not be an asshole, and not be elitist, and not be on the high horse of, I'm the master and my opinions are good? And you poor slob, you dumb motherfuckers are walking around in the dead of night. You just don't get it. That's not really the kind of master you want to be. So there's this famous modern Korean Zen master named Songsan. I'm sure some of you are familiar with him. And I only met him a couple of times, and I don't claim to know his teaching well, but he had this way of categorizing your understanding, your expression, your answer to his koans, and he would say that it was a like this answer. And then, better than the like this answers, were the just like this answers. And I was thinking about that recently, and maybe I think what he meant was that the like this answers are the seeing equality. Like when we do our chanting in English here, we say the wisdom of equality. The like this is seeing that all sentient and non-sentient energy is one activity, and everybody has Buddha nature. And maybe the just like this is recognizing all the painful delusion. It's recognizing the difference between love and hate and wisdom and delusion and violence and peace. And seeing that those painful differences are fundamentally transformable, fundamentally golden, and even a person who is hateful and causing great hurt truly is lovable and maybe even can be seen as brave because they aren't at peace with death, and maybe can be seen as even more beautiful and certainly more deserving of love and compassion than a Buddha. Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.